Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Thursday morning edition of The Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule today to join me on my program, The Cross in the Desert. We are taking a trip today from Iran, when usually our focus is on human rights issues and the happenings in Iran with my Iranian friends. I'm diverting today to take us to Bangladesh. I'm sure all of us have heard in the news the horrible atrocities once again ravaged by the evil ISIS. And today I want to focus in on this tragedy in a unique way. I want to pay tribute today to Abinta Kabir, Faraz Hussein, and Tarishi Jan, three university students who lost their lives in this horrendous attack. I want to put a face on these victims. We might have learned a little bit about them in the news, but this evil ISIS has once again snuffed out the lives of great human beings who have incredible potential in our world. And of course, I'm speaking of Abinta, Faraz, and Tarishi. And the only way I know how to bring about justice for them is to honor them today on The Cross in the Desert. I hope you will join me as we go back just about almost a week ago when this horrendous tragedy took place. It seems like during this month of Ramadan, and Ramadan not being over, that ISIS has used this month to rain terror from Orlando to Istanbul to Baghdad to Bangladesh. It seems like their face is always in the news. And I don't want to honor this evil entity, but I do want to honor these three university students today. One of them, Abinta Kabir, was an American citizen. And all that's happening in the news now with Hillary Clinton and everything that's going on, I want to spend this half an hour recognizing these three among the hostages that were killed and put a face on them. Let's hear about the attack right now on this special news item on the cross in the desert.
We're getting new details on the attack in Bangladesh, the chilling 12-hour siege inside an upscale bakery that left 20 hostages dead. Three of the victims were students at American universities. ABC's Jennifer Eccleston is on the story from our London bureau right now. Jennifer, good morning to you.
Hello, Dan. Indeed, heartbreak this morning for the families of the youngest victims of that bloody siege in Bangladesh as we learn more about three undergraduates at American universities who are among the dead.
Overnight, dramatic new amateur video of the moment commandos stormed a restaurant besieged by militants. The terrifying stream of gunfire ending a nearly 12-hour siege that killed 20 civilians.
It's a very long time to have that kind of standoff, especially when you're dealing with a terrorist group.
The attack targeting foreigners. Among the dead, three college students studying in the U.S., including 19-year-old Miami native Abinta Kabir, her former teacher, stunned.
It is so hard to believe that she was there and she was suffering for 10 or 11 hours. I don't even want to think about it.
The Emory University sophomore was visiting relatives in Dhaka when Islamic extremists attacked a Spanish restaurant, taking Kabir and dozens others hostage Friday. Kabir's friend and fellow Emory student, Faraz Hussein, reportedly died attempting to protect 19-year-old Berkeley student, Tarishi Jane. They were both killed. Survivors report the terrorist ordered hostages to recite verses from the Quran. Those unable to do so were killed.
They're looking to kill as many people as possible, and they're prepared to die for their cause.
ISIS and Al-Qaeda have taken credit for several brutal killings this year in this majority Muslim country once praised for religious tolerance.
This morning, police released photos of five of the terrorists. They say all are from Bangladesh and known to authorities as members of a banned extremist group and not ISIS. Another attacker remains in custody while the country begins 2 days of mourning. Paula?
Still some uncertainty about those claims of responsibility, Jennifer. Thank you.
It's just awful. They were unable to recite verses from the Quran, and consequently, they were hacked to death and killed by this horrible, evil entity. Tarishi Jane was on the cell phone with her father and basically told her father that she didn't think she and any of the others trapped and held hostage in this cafe were going to survive. I want you to hear some of the remarks made by the students at Berkeley, where Tarishi Jane was a student. Let's listen to this report.
We begin with new details on the deadly siege in Bangladesh. We now know all the attackers who stormed a crowded cafe in the capital city of Dhaka last night were Bangladeshi citizens. Five were militants who were already on a police wanted list. We've also learned three U.S. college students are among the 22 victims. One of them was a rising sophomore at UC Berkeley. KPIX5's Dahlin spoke to some of her fellow students who are trying to make sense of what happened.
Friends expressed their sadness on Facebook over the killing of Tarishi John. A friend at UC Berkeley wrote, "I can't really get myself to write about what a great human being and friend you were right now. But I hope you make the stars as wonderful a place as you did here with us." The Cal sophomore was interning at a company in Dhakar, Bangladesh, through a UC Berkeley program. Her father also has a business in that city. Cal sent out a statement saying her father was one of the family members waiting outside of the crime scene, hoping she would be rescued. The Indian national is one of the more than 20 people killed in the terrorist attacks. The university says Tarishi was going to study economics. She was very active on campus and got involved with the International Students Association. She also worked on a student-run nonprofit group called Ethical, which helps people in developing countries. Those who knew her say she was smart, ambitious, and had a big heart.
It's quite heartbreaking, and I'm pretty sure the community of Berkeley feels it We actually got sent an email by Chancellor Dirk.
Most students are home for the summer break, but those who heard about the tragedy are saddened by the news.
It's terrible to just end her life that short, to be somewhere where you thought you were going to go learn and you end up in a tragedy.
I feel sorry for her family and I hope that they're okay and they can deal with that.
The student body will be planning a vigil and memorial on campus. They hope to release information about that soon. At UC Berkeley, I'm Da Lin, KPIX 5.
UC Berkeley says seven other Cal students are doing the same internship in DACA. Campus leaders are making sure those students are safe, and they're trying to decide whether to get those students out of that area.
Tarishi Jane, a beautiful human being with great potential, her life snuffed out by an extremist group of Muslims that are raining terror all over the world. Anushe Hussain grew up in Bangladesh, and she remembers quite vividly this particular cafe and where the hostage crisis took place. Let's listen to this special CBS report with Anushe Hussain.
We've been learning more about the hostages killed in Friday's terror attack in Bangladesh. Three of the victims were students studying at universities in the United States, and among the others were nine Italian citizens, seven Japanese citizens, and three Bangladeshis. The siege occurred at a popular cafe in the capital's diplomatic zone, about a mile from the U.S. Embassy. With me now from Washington is Anushe Hussain, journalist for AnusheSPoint.com. Anushe, you are Bangladeshi and have many family and friends in Dhaka. What have you been learning from them about Friday's attack?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. And I was actually born and raised in Bangladesh, and my family still lives there. And the news, I was just back there in April, and the news that is coming out is just horrifying. The situation isn't as fluid as it was Friday night, but of course, we're still learning more and more information. And I really, really want our viewers to understand this. I keep stipulating this, but Bangladesh, Dhaka, Bangladesh is not Kabul, Afghanistan. It's not Baghdad, Iraq. This was not the heart of the diplomatic zone. It was the heart of the city. These are very integrated communities. Bangladesh is a huge aid success story, so the aid community there is very big. We're finding out such shocking details by the day. It turns out that the people that were responsible for this attack were not, you know, students from a madrasa, but students from affluent families who actually went to school in that area of Gulshan. And I mean, people are just in shock. A lot of people are turning their profile pictures on Facebook to black, and you know, they've started a hashtag for Dhaka Strong, but we have never seen an attack like this. I mean, I'm still in shock.
What can you tell us, Anushe, about the bakery that the militants chose to target?
The bakery that the militants chose to target was really, it was one of the best restaurants in town. It's actually owned by family friends. And, you know, my three sisters live in this area. One of my sisters lives just two streets down from Holy Bakery. My nephews go there every other day. This is a place where, this used to be the home of a very well-loved doctor in the country. It's right across from Lakeview Gulshan Clinic. I can't tell how many of these children that this woman personally delivered that ended up going and, you know, playing in the garden of that cafe. And I mean, it's absolutely crazy. We heard from the owner of the cafe today. Sadat made a Facebook posting, and everyone's trying to be defiant and saying that we're going to build again. But honestly, people are in such shock. This is a very small community. Everybody is so connected. Two of the victims were students at Emory University here. One of them was a grandson of a very good family friend of my mom's. I mean, everybody is so connected. Everybody knew somebody. And a lot of the other things that are coming out on social media that is so, it's traumatic, are the text messages that victims sent to their family and friends before they were slaughtered and massacred. One of the kitchen staff texted his brother and said, "We're in the bathroom. It's so hot here. If you can get somebody to break the wall in and rescue us, please help us." I mean, the evil and the blood and the trauma, it's all coming out. Everyone's just trying to piece information together.
Absolutely terrifying. All right. Our thoughts are certainly with you and your friends and family. Anushe Hussain in Washington. Anushe, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Fred.
Anushe Hussain, who grew up there, who knows the community very well, who's very familiar with the cafe, and you can tell just the trauma in her voice as she describes this incredibly evil weekend. Today, my thoughts and my prayers go out to the families of the victims in Bangladesh, in particular the families of Abinta Kabir, Faraz Hussein, and Tarishi Jane, three incredible human beings, and their talents and their potential were snuffed out by an evil entity. Which brings us to the question this morning on the cross in the desert. The age-old question is, why evil? Why does a good God allow so much evil in his planet, in his world? Are there answers to this question? Many of us grapple with these questions, especially after a traumatic event like this, and we ask, why evil? Why God? Why so much suffering and why so much evil? And that's a very good question in light of everything that we have witnessed by watching the news and listened to, and we're bombarded with these philosophical dilemmas. Why? Are there really good answers to that? Well, just recently, I saw a great program on the soft topic of evil and suffering on the John Ankerberg Show, and one of the guests was philosopher, theologian, apologetics expert, and his name was Norman Geisler. And I thought that in just a few minutes, he was able to shed some insight into this topic, and I want you to hear his answer to the question that all of us ask, why evil? Why so much evil in the presence of a good God? Let's listen.
All right, frame it. We've only got a few minutes left. What does the content that we've even discussed today, first of all, tell us about the God we're talking about?
It tells us that he's all good. It tells us that he's all powerful. If he's all good, he has a good purpose for everything that happens. If he's all powerful, he can bring a good out of evil. And he's all knowing, so he knows where this thing is going. He's not a divine architect of the universe that builds staircases that lead to nowhere. Every staircase that looks like it's going nowhere to us is going somewhere to him, and you can be sure of it.
How is it encouraging? How is it good for us to know the nature of evil?
All is good that ends good. All is well that ends well, we say. So if we know that it's just temporary, if we know it has a good purpose in mind, then we can endure it a whole lot more easily than if we don't know where it's going and we don't know there's anyone who knows where it's going.
Why is it good to know that evil originated with free choice and God didn't create it?
Because then you know that God is absolutely good. You know that God is not evil in any sense, because if he originated evil, then he's evil.
And how can a person who says, you know, I'd like to come into a relationship with that God, I didn't even know that I could, how do you get to know him personally? What has he made possible for us?
He's made possible for us a solution to evil. See, and the encouraging thing is this God is not only all-powerful, but he's all-loving. And he's permitting this evil for a purpose. In fact, he permitted the greatest evil that has ever occurred on earth to his own son. He permitted him to go to the cross, to die for our sins, to rise from the dead, that we can be delivered from evil. So God permitted evil to defeat evil. He permitted his son's suffering so that we wouldn't have to suffer forever. He permitted evil in our lives to remind us, as Lewis said in his great book, The Problem of Pain, evil is God's megaphone to arouse a morally deaf world. And so all these evil circumstances are to turn us to God. I was lying in the hospital in 1954 with hepatitis, looking up. That's the only way you can look when you're lying on your back. And believe me, God had my attention, because God shouts to us in our pain. Pain is God's megaphone to arouse a morally deaf world.
Pain is God's megaphone to arouse a morally deaf world. The Problem of Pain, C.S. Lewis. I think that Norman Geisler, in just a couple of minutes, gave us a little bit of insight. God is all-powerful, and God is all-good. God is not responsible for the evil, but God allows evil through our free choices. If we didn't have free choice to choose, we would be robots, and then God's love would be nothing more than a cosmic rape attack on us. So freedom of choice is a necessary component of what it means to be human. But that doesn't solve the hurt and the pain of evil, does it? But it gives us insight into knowing that God allows it for a purpose, that he doesn't build staircases in the universe that go nowhere. They have a purpose, and it's only temporary. And as Norman pointed out, the greatest evil that God allowed was the death of his own son on a cross. And there was a purpose behind that. Jesus died in our place so that we could be delivered, that we could be saved. And that was evil, what was done to Jesus. But through this whole purpose, we can be saved. That may not answer all of your questions, and so we're going to continue on exploring this topic of why does God allow pain and suffering. Let's listen to this next soundbite and get more insight.
Hook on to your syllogism, and they use it this way, okay? If God's all good, and we say that he is, he would defeat evil. If God's all powerful, he could defeat evil. But then they say, but evil never will be defeated. In other words, it's going to go on just the way it is here. Therefore, no such God exists. This is all, you're all pipe dreaming here.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what they're doing, because they don't know the end from the beginning as the God of Isaiah does. They don't know how things are going to turn out, and God does. So God, who knows everything, and God, who is all good, permits this, knowing exactly how much it will take to achieve his greater good. And he knows the end from the beginning, and he knows it's going to turn out well, because he's planned it that way, that he would permit evil to achieve the greater good. He would permit pain to produce the ultimate pleasure. He would let us go through the wilderness in order that we can get to the promised land. And, of course, when we get to the promised land and we look back on it, we're going to say what Paul did in 2 Corinthians 4:16. This light affliction, which is but for a moment, worked for us a far more exceeding and greater weight of glory.
Yeah, I think to the atheist who says it, you have a great note in your book. There's no way for the atheist to know evil never will be defeated unless he is God himself.
Yeah, he'd have to be omniscient. He'd have to know everything in order to know that it's never going to turn out well.
But let's come back to the guy that is in his bed, and he's sick, and he is suffering, like my mom, okay? He's in it right now, okay? What is the basis? What are the hooks that he can grab onto that says, I can hope that it will be defeated someday up ahead?
I think it was about 1958. I was listening to Paul Harvey one day. He said he went into the hospital to visit a young man dying of cancer. He went in to comfort him, and he came out comforted because the young man looked at him and said, Paul, I don't believe that the divine architect of the universe ever builds a staircase that leads to nowhere. If you know you have a divine architect, and he knows everything and he's all good, you can be absolutely sure that it's leading somewhere. I've been in that kind of bed. I've been there lying on my back dying of hepatitis, couldn't raise my hand. My wife and church were praying for me. Somebody gave me a poem I'll never forget. It was called Overheard in an Orchard. It said, the robin to the sparrow, I should really like to know why these anxious human beings rush about and worry so. Said the sparrow to the robin, I think that it must be that they have no heavenly father such as cares for you and me.
Mm.
That's the answer.
Again, some insight into the problem of suffering and evil. That is Norman Geisler and John Ankerberg. A few years ago, I wrote a blog entitled Hope in the Face of Death. And I'm going to read this to you and ask that you just listen carefully to the words. In light of what we've talked about this morning with the evil acts of ISIS in Bangladesh, the death of three beautiful university students and many others, I hope that the words of my blog this morning will give you comfort. If you're facing a difficult situation, if you're going through trials with evil and suffering and tribulation, and then you think about the events that have happened in our world in just this last month, you feel like your hope has been diminished. All of us face the inevitable reality of death one day. It is a subject we prefer not to talk about and instead continue to make plans and pursue our dreams. Yet, it's unavoidable. Death is all around us. Our lives are rudely interrupted by the tragic news of a best friend killed in a car wreck or a next-door neighbor facing terminal cancer. The headline news is filled with murders, violence, and stories of incredible suffering and evil. The lives of people are shattered by this painful reality. Are there any answers that can give us hope in the face of death? Nearly 2,000 years ago, words of hope were spoken to a young Jewish woman named Martha and her sister Mary. Their brother Lazarus had suddenly died, and their lives were filled with grief and mourning until Jesus arrived on the scene. Jesus gave Martha words of hope that shattered the darkness and reality of death. Jesus proclaimed, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live." This is an incredible declaration that looks death right in the face and says, quote, "I have the final word." Jesus wasn't just trying to encourage Martha with a pep talk to soothe her hurts and pains. No. Right before the eyes of Martha and Mary and others gathered in the village of Bethany, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." Still wrapped in grave clothes, Lazarus emerged from the tomb to the astonishment of Mary and Martha. Death and decay were powerless against the command of Jesus, and Lazarus was living proof that Jesus was exactly who he claimed to be, the resurrection and the life. Millions of followers of Jesus courageously risk their lives every day, refusing to recant their faith because they have the assurance that at the instant of their death, they will stand before their living Savior, never to die again. We live in a culture of fear and hopelessness, with the certainty of death lingering all around us, interrupting our plans and dreams for the good life. As a result, many put their hope and faith in science or the latest diet fads to help them prolong their lives. However, the incredible promise of Jesus is the only words of hope that can overcome and destroy the sinful curse of death upon the human race. The promises of scientific progress and the claims of diet fads are built upon a shaky foundation in comparison to the promise of Jesus. You and I can confidently look death in the face and have real hope and assurance when we trust in Jesus. He alone has the words of eternal life. The curse of death is forever swallowed up by the greatest words ever uttered: "I am the resurrection and the life." These are words of hope and comfort. They are true words. They are words of living reality. Death is powerless at the command and at the words of Jesus when he declares, "I am the resurrection and the life." Well, right now I'm going to divert from any more stories of violence, any more stories of heartache and sorrow. I'm going to take you into my world of the wind and the waves right now as I continue reading my book, Driven by the Wind, The Calling of Tara. But before that, we're going to be entertained and brought into that world of the wind and the waves through this acoustic version of Christopher Cross's Sailing. And when we come back, I'll begin reading. Thank you. the beautiful instrumental music of a classic song by Christopher Cross entitled Sailing. It's appropriate music for the book I'm going to read with you this morning. Last blog talk, I began a reading of my book, Driven by the Wind, The Calling of Terra. So I invite you, pull up a chair and a glass of cool, refreshing iced tea, and just lay back and let me take you into the world of the wind and the waves. We are still in chapter one of Driven by the Wind, The Calling of Terra. Climbing back up the spiraling staircase from the beach, Terra once more stood atop the cliff. A few sailboats were gliding across the choppy early morning waves, heading out toward the mouth of San Diego Bay. Fishermen on the pier were packing up their gear and heading back home after a long morning with no success. The beach was beginning to get crowded with children laughing and kicking up the sand. Terra smiled in spite of her pain and began walking toward the lighthouse. The sound and smells of the beach filled her whole being. The brisk wind blew her reddish-brown hair across her face. There was no place in the world like Ocean Park. Terra remembered how her father would take her and Nathan on long walks along the cliff, and then at Lighthouse Point, they would release their kites into the wind and watch them soar. Terra stopped a few feet in front of the lighthouse. The black and white towering cone-shaped marble structure towered 225 feet into the air. It was a familiar but ominous sight to Terra. Memories from long ago filled her soul. She gently massaged her forehead. Sharp pains shot across her face from ear to ear. Terra winced and covered her face with her hands. She felt she had stood here just a few hours ago when it was pitch black at night. The moonlight was glistening on the ocean and the pink, bright lighthouse lanterns were beaming out across the dark Pacific Ocean. It was the dream. Terra looked up at the lighthouse. This was exactly how the dream began. In her dream, she was standing right at this place, facing the lighthouse. Terra walked up to the door and opened it. There was an echo as the door creaked. Terra stared at the black iron spiraling staircase that led all the way up to the top where the lantern room was located. She slowly took a hold of the staircase and began climbing upward. It was so ominously quiet and peaceful, yet, just like in the dream, Terra felt a presence behind her as she ascended up the staircase. Terra's heart began to pound in her chest. Cold drops of sweat rolled down her cheeks. Terra continued to climb. Then suddenly she stopped. The sound of the door creaking open below seized her attention. This was just like in her dream. Her hands trembling on the railing, Terra looked down below her. She saw a tiny shaft of light spill across the floor. She was not alone. Her heart began racing in her chest. Terra covered her mouth with her hands in fear. Then quickly, she once again grasped the railing with her right hand and began to climb faster. The top seemed so far away. Then suddenly, Terra slipped and fell forward, banging her knee on the hard, cold staircase. Quickly, she regained her balance and began to climb, grasping for breath. Thump, thump, thump. Someone was climbing up the staircase right below. The sound of footsteps right behind sent chills of fear up her spine. Terra struggled to keep her balance and hold onto the railing. She was feeling dizzy and weak and... Then, just like in the dream, the footsteps stopped. Terra stood still. She gasped for breath. Her heart was pounding in her chest. As Terra paused from climbing halfway to the top, she remembered what happened next in her dream. She closed her eyes. The next scene in her dream was somewhere far away from the lighthouse, somewhere else in the world. It didn't look familiar to her at all. In the dream, she found herself standing in the middle of a busy street crowded with people celebrating like at Mardi Gras. There were dozens of cars, a parade, people dressed in costumes, and a band playing loud music for the celebration. Desperate to get away, Terra fought her way through the crowd of people to the other side of the street. On the other side of the street stood a large community hospital. Terra remembered feeling compelled to walk through the front entrance of the hospital into the lobby. She She hurriedly caught the elevator and took it to the 10th floor. Quickly getting off the elevator, Tara raced down the corridor to room 23 and opened up the door. Walking into the hospital room, Tara noticed a man sitting in a chair, staring out a window with his back to her. Slowly, Tara approached the man from behind. She was anxious to see her face. Then, the dream abruptly ended, and she woke up. This was always how the dream would end every time, beginning in the lighthouse and concluding at a mysterious hospital room. Tara was confused and perplexed. What did it all mean? It must have some kind of meaning. Exhausted from her journey up the lighthouse stairs, Tara decided to head back home for breakfast. She had spent enough time this morning confronting her demons, and there were still more questions than answers. Chapter 2, The Crisis. O Lord, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. Saint Augustine, The Confessions. Tara stared mindlessly at her computer screen. She wasn't in the mood to work today. All she could think about was her experience in the lighthouse this morning and the dream. She leaned back in her chair and covered her face with her hands and took a deep breath. I can't do this anymore, Tara blurted out in a tone of disgust. Tara had been employed for the last 3 years as a computer software designer at Nautilus. Nautilus was a leading software corporation serving major business firms all over the world. When Tara's father died a year ago, he had left both her and her mother, Evelyn, a sizable inheritance. In all reality, Tara could have retired and never worked another day in her life. However, Tara didn't want handouts. She was both free-spirited and fiercely independent. Her father had not only taught her how to sail, but also trained her to work hard with her hands. For Tara to retire and travel all over the world, enjoying the single life, was very tempting but undoable. Tara had a passion to work hard and make all of her dreams come true. It was unthinkable for her to be given her whole life on a silver platter. There were oceans to cross and mountains to climb, and Tara wasn't about to live the life of a spoiled rich kid. For Tara, life was an adventure to experience and a mystery to be solved. Yet now, Tara's life was slowly crumbling into a pile of broken dreams and unanswered questions. She could still see Nathan's sailboat on the horizon. The pain and the brokenness had become too much for her to bear. Tara leaned forward once again and quickly logged off of her computer. Tara stood up and wiped the tears off of her face with a Kleenex. It was almost lunchtime. The workload was piling up. She hadn't accomplished much in the last 3 hours. She walked into the restroom to run a comb through her hair. She stood staring at herself in the mirror. Her blue eyes had turned red from crying. Tara straightened her blue blouse and tucked it down into her light brown dress slacks. Standing in front of the mirror, Tara realized that her life was quickly slipping away from her. She didn't feel very much in control anymore. For Tara, not to be in control was the unpardonable sin. She had always been in control. Nothing or no one was going to lecture her on morality or life. Tara could think for herself. After combing through her reddish brown hair and refreshing up, Tara got a grip on herself and headed toward the break room for lunch. The familiar sight of Scott, her coworker, lifting a hot cup of tomato soup from out of the microwave caught Tara's attention as she strolled into the break room and flopped down in the chair. Scott had a ritual every lunchtime, a tuna fish sandwich and a cup of steaming hot tomato soup drowning in saltine crackers. The familiar sight put a smile on Tara's face as she poured Italian dressing on her salad. Stirring his hot cup of soup with a spoon, Scott gently blew over his cup and sat down facing Tara. Scott and Tara had been good friends ever since she was promoted to software design at Nautilus. Just 6 months ago, Scott had lost his wife, Maria, to breast cancer. Tara observed as Scott bravely accepted his wife's death and was able to be strong for his children in the midst of very difficult circumstances. Scott attributed his strength and courage to his Christian faith. Tara and Scott had shared many lively and sometimes intense discussions about God, religion, and worldviews. Tara respected his beliefs and oftentimes challenged his views, asking many questions and engaging Scott in heated debates. In spite of their religious difference, Tara accepted and admired Scott as a husband, father, and diligent co-worker. Tara would sometimes look at Scott face to face and amusingly object to his argument by simply asserting, quote, "I'm sorry, Scott, Christianity is just not my pathway." End of discussion. Usually Scott would get a huge grin on his face, take a deep breath, and shake his head. He realized there was no penetrating Tara's free-spirited barrier. As Scott lifted the spoon once more to his lips, he stopped and gazed intently at Tara. He pushed back his glasses on his nose and dropped the plastic spoon into his soup cup. "You're awfully quiet today, Tara. Is something wrong?" Tara stared aimlessly at the wall behind Scott. She couldn't bring herself to make eye contact with him. After a few moments, she dropped her head and looked into Scott's brown eyes. "I can't take it anymore," Tara emphatically admitted. There was silence for a moment as Scott searched for the right words to say to Tara. He dabbed his lips with a napkin and folded his hands on the table. "Do you want to talk about it?" Scott asked with concern in his voice. Tara dropped her elbows down on the table with an angry thud and bowed her head. "I've reached the end," Tara announced. Scott swallowed nervously and leaned closer to Tara. "This is about Nathan, isn't it?" Scott asked, gently probing Tara. Tara nervously bit her lower lip and shook her head. Tears welled up in her eyes. Scott reached across the table and touched the tops of Tara's hands. "I'm sorry, Tara." Tara pulled her hands back and grabbed a Kleenex to dab her eyes with. "I didn't want to do this. I mean, break down. I need to be strong." Tara could see the humiliation in Tara's eyes shining through. He understood Tara was extremely independent and needed to hold her emotions together. It was important to Tara that she always appeared strong and not needing to rely on anyone else but herself. Self-sufficiency was the most important building block in Tara's worldview. According to Tara's principles, if she was unable to control her emotions and instead live in panic and fear, this was an unacceptable weakness that had to be eliminated. Tara knew she had now compromised an important principle. She realized that her world was slowly crumbling before her eyes. Tara could see compassion and understanding in Scott's eyes. She was impressed how respectfully he carried his faith. Inside, Tara felt like she was falling apart. "It's okay to show your emotions, Tara," Scott reassured her. "I'm your friend." Tara nodded her head in agreement and then leaned back in her chair and rolled her eyes in frustration. She inhaled, taking a deep breath, struggling to relax. "I've had it," Tara adamantly said. She leaned forward and stared intently into Scott's eyes. "I have to get away." Scott looked puzzled. He sat quietly gazing into Tara's eyes. Tara pushed her salad out of the way and slammed the fork down on the table. "I need answers." Scott remained calm and listened intently to Tara. "Please let me help you, Tara," Scott gently said with a tone of pleading in his voice. Tara looked away for a moment. "Scott, I appreciate your concern," Tara gratefully said. I know that you believe the answers to every problem can be found in a book, and I respect you. But for me, the answers lie somewhere out there," Tara explained. She had a trance-like expression on her face. "Out there?" Scott asked. Tara stared back at Scott. "Out there? In the world of the wind and waves," Tara answered with a magical and excited look on her face. "My answers are out there, somewhere on the ocean." Scott had a perplexed look on his face. "What are you saying, Tara?" Tara smiled. She looked as though she had been transported into another world. "Whenever I'm afraid or hurt or just need a place to go and get away and think, all I have to do is get into my sailboat and I will find the answers that I need. Scott could see a look of awe and wonder in Tara's eyes because she was describing her world, the world of the wind and waves. Scott leaned back into his chair and dabbed his mouth with the napkin. Tara turned back and looked Scott in the eyes. She could see a look of pain written all over his face. She knew he was remembering Maria. I remember Maria's last days, Tara. I watched her slip away a little more each day. A single tear trickled down Scott's face. I'm so sorry, Tara said consolingly. I'm so sorry if I caused you to relive that. No, Scott said insistently. I just wanted to explain, when you say you were in pain and you hurt and you need to get away, you go out in the ocean in your sailboat. I understand that, Tara. But when I get hurt, I cry out to God. He's my refuge. He understands my pain. I know when I cry out to him, he's listening and he cares. Scott's face beamed with joy. I could have never gotten through Maria's cancer without his grace. Tara nodded her head with respect and understanding. Suddenly, Scott got a serious expression on his face. He turned around in his chair and looked intently into Tara's eyes. Tara, can I ask you a personal question? Tara looked a little puzzled. Sure, Scott. What is it? Scott smiled and relaxed. You know, your father was your hero, Tara. Your father was your mentor for life. He was also a Christian like me, a man of deep faith. He was your hero, yet. So why didn't I believe like him? Tara said, interrupting. She looked down at the table, deep in thought. Then she lifted up her head and looked seriously at Scott. He was my hero, Tara proudly said. I remember going to church with him as a little girl. I also remember going out on the sailboat with him. Tara's eyes beamed with joy as she remembered her father. On the sailboat, Tara said with a glow in her eyes, I felt a freedom that I've never felt anywhere else. Tara's facial expression suddenly changed to a despaired look. At church, I felt trapped, squeezed. I always wanted to run out the back door. Do you understand the difference, Scott? I see what you mean, Tara. Let me say it this way, Scott explained. What I believe is, as a Christian, is life-changing. It's not bondage. There is real freedom in knowing Christ. It's a relationship, Tara, not a religion. I don't feel trapped in it at all. I can be everything God created me to be. I can have the same exhilaration and freedom that you have when you're out on your sailboat. Tara nodded her head and smacked her lips together. All I can say, Scott, is if that what makes you happy, then it's true for you. But for me, it's not. Religion is bondage. I feel trapped by it. It's just not my pathway. Scott knew instinctively that it was best not to try to answer Tara's objection. He returned to his bowl of tomato soup and tuna fish sandwich. The free spirit had spoken. End of discussion. Tara drove her red convertible Mustang up the steep hill and parked it in front of her summer home. It had been a very long and stressful day at work. It was finally time to come home and relax. The cool ocean breeze blew softly across her face. It felt so good to Tara to finally be home. Tara walked through the front screen door. The door slammed, startled James. James jumped up from the couch and rubbed his black-bearded, unshaven face. Hi, honey, James said, yawning. James could tell right away that Tara was extremely tired and not in a good mood. Tara didn't reply. Instead, she flung the car keys down on the kitchen table and flopped down on the couch, kicking off her shoes to relax. She leaned her head back against the couch and exhaled a deep breath. James scooted over next to Tara and gently kissed her up and down her neck. I'm going to help you forget about your bad day, James promised in a romantic tone of voice. He kept running the edge of his tongue up and down Tara's neck. Slowly, he slid his fingers underneath Tara's belt buckle and gently pressed them up against her abdomen. Tara angrily yanked his fingers out from underneath her belt buckle and stood up. James looked shocked. My God! What's wrong? I'm just trying to help you feel better, Tara. Tara shook her head in disgust and took a deep breath, staring angrily into James's eyes. That's all you ever think of. James rolled his eyes back and sighed. What the hell is wrong with you lately? Tara marched into the kitchen and pulled open the refrigerator door. She quickly slammed it in a rage. She peeled off the tab on a can of beer and sat down at the kitchen table. I'm tired of you smothering me, James. Oh, here we go, James said with a mocking tone, shaking his head and rolling his eyes. Miss Independent, free spirit has spoken. You damn right, Tara fired back in an assertive and angry tone, and you knew that going in. James slowly walked up to the kitchen table and sat down across from Tara. Can we talk about this? James said with a pleading tone in his voice. Tara ran her head through her reddish-brown hair and leaned back in her chair. Clutching the can of beer with her left hand, she took a quick, angry gulp. I need my space. I need to get away, Tara complained, staring into space. James nodded his head in agreement. Okay, sure. Why don't you and me take a few days and head down to Mexico for some rest and relaxation? Tara took another gulp of beer and shook her head in frustration. I need to get away by myself. Oh, so I am a bother to you, James answered in a sarcastic tone. Tara got up abruptly from the table and headed toward the bedroom. James shook his head and slammed his fist down into the kitchen table in anger. Tara quickly changed into some comfortable jeans and put on her jacket. I'm going for a walk on the beach. She put a tiny flashlight in her jacket and headed out the door. When Tara stepped out the front door and inhaled the salty air blowing in from the ocean, all of her stress immediately vanished. Orange and purple color streaks were bursting over the horizon as sunset approached. Tara lifted her arms jubilantly up into the air with delight and inhaled the ocean air. She closed her eyes and shouted hallelujah at the top of her lungs. Then she did a little dance in her bare feet and laughed. I'm not religious, but I can't help shouting, Tara said amusingly, chuckling out loud to herself. As she approached the cliff to walk down the stairs, she suddenly stopped and gazed toward the lighthouse. In the distance, she could see a beam of light flashing out into the bay from the lantern room. Suddenly, Tara was seized by an overwhelming feeling. While her heart wanted to race down the stairs for a moonlight walk on the beach, she couldn't move. She stood still, like she was paralyzed. She was unable to walk toward the stairs. Instead, Tara was seized by a mystical force, like an inward tugging at her heart, urging her to walk toward the lighthouse instead of the beach. There's that feeling again, that urging, that longing, Tara whispered out loud. It felt like the dream once again. Tara turned away from the cliff and instead started walking toward the lighthouse. The ocean breeze blew softly across her face with a tantalizing feeling. Tara felt like that she was in a trance, unable to do anything but to keep walking toward the lighthouse. Sunset had arrived. Tara felt inside of her pocket. She had a flashlight that she usually bought with her when walking alone on the beach at night. Tara drew closer to the lighthouse. The cone-shaped landmark was the place where she and Nathan played hide-and-seek when they were kids. Suddenly, Tara halted. Her eyes grew big with fright. It looked like a shadow, like someone was wandering around inside the lighthouse. She could see an ominous figure peering out at her from the window. Tara grasped in fear. What was someone doing inside an old, deserted lighthouse and peering out the window at her at this time of the night? She muttered to herself. Cold chills shot up and down her spine. Tara walked faster, unafraid. She was determined to find out why she had been dreaming about the lighthouse. Why was she being tormented almost every night in her dreams about this? As Tara came within 50 feet of the lighthouse, the shadowy figure suddenly vanished. Tara hesitated. Was she going insane? Who was this shadowy figure? Was it real or just her mind playing tricks on her? What is it? Tara took a long, deep breath and composed herself. She grabbed the doorknob tightly in her left hand. Her hand was trembling with fear. She slowly pushed open the door. A shrill creaking noise echoed throughout the empty eye house. It was pitch black inside. Tara reached into her pocket and pulled out her flashlight and quickly turned it on. A bright beam of light flashed across the cold, dark floor, exposing the dust, dirt, and cobwebs. Suddenly, the beam of light landed on a shiny object lying on the floor next to the black iron staircase. Tara slowly and carefully crept inside and let the door slam behind her. Her whole body was trembling with fear and apprehension. She slowly walked toward the staircase, keeping her flashlight aimed on the shiny object lying on the concrete floor. Tara stopped, keeping the beam of light aimed on the object. She carefully bent down and picked it up off the floor. It was a shiny, brand-new-looking silver key. She held the silver key up to her face. "Who does this belong to?" Tara mumbled out loud to herself. "Why did I find this?" Tara was baffled and perplexed. She glanced around the old dark lighthouse and aimed the beam in a circular direction. Then she glanced back at the key, holding it tightly between the fingers of her left hand. Suddenly, Tara was startled by a loud crash. She dropped her flashlight, and the key fell out of her hand onto the floor. Tara's heart began pounding with fear. Beads of sweat rolled down the cheeks of her face. Tara leaned up against the staircase, frightened, panicked, and out of breath. She quickly picked up her flashlight and the key from off the floor. Tara was now fully determined to get the answer she needed to finally put an end to her nightmare. And thus, we end the reading of Chapter 2 from my book, Driven by the Wind, The Calling of Tara. We will begin Chapter 3 on the next Cross in the Desert. I want to say God bless everyone and thank you for coming today. I will see you again on Monday.